can I ask you about the Goldstone Commission? Why did Israel not cooperate with it?
I think because clearly we saw that it was going to be terribly biased from the very beginning, and there was little point in cooperating.
But didn't not cooperating make it more likely that it would be biased against you?
Well, I'm not sure there was much of a chance anyway. I mean, they approached a number of people before they approached Goldstone. The most famous, I think, of the people they approached Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, former UN Human Rights Commissioner. And she refused because she said the mandate of Goldstone was just so biased, openly, extremely biased, that there was no point.
Richard Goldstone has a very high reputation from his previous work. He is, in fact, I believe, Jewish by origin himself. Why were you suspicious of him?
Well, it doesn't have to be personal, but frankly, I would have more respect for him had he followed the lead of Mary Robinson. I mean, this Human Rights Council of the United Nations, I mean, it's called a Human Rights Council, but the people who sit there are countries with atrocious human rights records, countries like Syria, Sudan, Somalia, Saudi Arabia. And they've used the council, instead of talking about human rights, they use it as a vehicle just to attack my country.
But you could say that about the whole United Nations. It's got a lot of bad countries in it, but you still cooperate with the United Nations.
But the council is unfortunately dominated by these sort of countries who, as I say, have got atrocious human rights records and just use it. I mean, they've in the last few years since they've been established, they've published some 25 resolutions, 20 of them have been pointed against Israel. And I'd remind you, Israel's the only country in the Middle East that has a free press, that has a free trade union movement, that has free universities, that has elections that really matter. I mean, the whole idea that this Human Rights Council is totally focused in this anti-Israel agenda, it's not something that just I say. Both the previous Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, and the current Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, have both criticized the council for its anti-Israel obsession.
But they didn't criticize the Goldstone Commission, did they? And the Goldstone Commission was apparently even-handed in that it said that both sides had committed war crimes.
Well, I'd remind you, if I could, that all the democratic countries that sit on the Human Rights Council, Japan, South Korea, Canada, the European countries, they all opposed the Goldstone mandate. They refused to support it. And I think a lot of those countries today are trying to bury this document as quickly as possible, because everyone understands the danger in adopting this report.
But you've already said that you don't accept that it should have happened in the first place, but let's talk about its conclusions. As I say, that it said that both sides had committed war crimes.
First of all, do you know what they actually did? They came into the Gaza Strip, a territory controlled by a very violent and authoritarian regime run by Hamas, and they conducted public hearings. Now, having a public hearing in that sort of circumstances, it's like having a Stalinist show trial. They heard exactly what they wanted to hear. They heard all this testimony just condemning Israel. Well, of course, no one can say anything against Hamas, because if they do, Goldstone leaves, Hamas will, of course, take immediate violent retribution against the people who'd speak out against them. It was just a show trial. It was a travesty.
Well, let's just talk about the specifics, though. What about the allegation that your troops actually killed civilians on occasions deliberately?
Civilians were unfortunately caught up in the crossfire in Gaza. That's a fact. And we're actually investigating this ourselves. We've got some 100 investigations going on at the moment. More than 20 have already reached the stage where the military police have launched a criminal investigation, because we do hold ourselves to a higher standard. But the assumption that Israel as a policy targeted innocent civilians is simply not true. We made every effort during that conflict not to target civilians. We made every effort to avoid seeing civilians caught up in the crossfire. We dropped leaflets. We warned people to leave combat areas. We even made cell phone calls to all the numbers in the Gaza directory. We made every effort possible to avoid seeing civilians.
By saying that, you seem to be prejudging the efforts of the inquiries you've just been talking about. They will find your soldiers not guilty.
Well, I don't know, because there can, of course, be specific circumstances where soldiers acted not according to their orders. But if you ask me, was there a policy to take every effort possible to avoid civilian casualties, there was such a policy. That was clearly the orders given to soldiers going into combat.
Was white phosphorus used as an incendiary device?
Yes, it was, and that's totally in accordance with international law, NATO forces use white phosphorus in places like Afghanistan and other places. You're allowed to use white phosphorus for signalling. You can use it for making smoke cover. I think I wouldn't be surprised if the Australian military uses it as well.
It's not legal to use it as an incendiary device against people, though, is it?
Oh, definitely not, and we didn't.
So any evidence that they came up with that contradicted that, you deny?
No, we would look into that very, very seriously, and we have already looked into it very seriously. Once again, white phosphorus is not allowed to be used as an anti-personnel weapon.
Now, Hina Jilani, who was on the Goldstone Commission, was here a little while ago, and I questioned her quite strongly about their use of the word occupation. They say that you have an occupation of Gaza. She says that you do. You say that you don't.
Well, it's clear that we don't, and I think this is just, unfortunately, part of the warped agenda of this council. I mean, the only Israeli in Gaza today as we speak is that young serviceman still being held hostage for 3 years, Gilad Shalit. There aren't Israelis in Gaza. Who has effective control of the Gaza Strip? It's the Hamas movement. And to say that Israel occupies Gaza is simply to ignore reality.
Why do you think that the Gaza war in particular caused such international anger?
I'm not sure I've got a good answer, and I'm being very frank. It's difficult to see, difficult to understand. I mean, ultimately...
You don't think it's something to do with the extraordinary imbalance of power?
Well, let's look at what happened. Israel pulled out of the Gaza Strip in 2005. We vacated all our military installations there. We pulled down all the settlements. Those settlers who didn't want to leave were forcibly evicted, and we redeployed behind what's recognized as the international border. And then we had a whole rain of rockets, not one, not two, not ten, but thousands of rockets from Gaza raining down on Israeli cities. And we waited and we waited, but in the end we had to act to defend our people. I'd ask you, what would Australia do if rockets were raining down on Australian cities? Would you not act to defend your people?
Now let's talk about the West Bank. What is Israel actually going to do to prevent the settlements expanding?
We've already made a commitment. Prime Minister Netanyahu has said clearly we won't be building new settlements and we won't be outwardly expanding existing ones. There'll be no expropriation whatsoever of any disputed land for the purposes of making an existing settlement bigger. And we're willing to go further in the framework of a peace process that works.
You say that, but then there keep on being apparent breaches of that.
No, I was very clear. We're not building new settlements and we won't outwardly expand existing ones.
All right, so you can build upwards inside existing ones, for
what
instance.
We've said
you can have a greatly increased population density in the settlements.
What we're saying is we want to allow normal life to continue inside an existing community. If there's a need for a school, a need for a health clinic, a need for a synagogue, a need for some other institution to meet the needs of the people there. That's what we're asking for, not more.
But to be clear, there are settlements and there are what you might call outposts.
Correct.
The outposts can become settlements. It looks to the Palestinians as though Israel is constantly just pushing out, pushing out.
I think if you look at it, and you look at it fairly, you'll see that actually what's going on in the West Bank over the last year or so is there's been a lot of good news. If you look at the IMF report for growth on the West Bank, it's projected to be this year at 7%. I mean, the whole world is in recession. The West Bank economy is growing at 7%, and this is not happening by accident. This is happening because the Israeli government and the Palestinian government are taking steps in tandem to make sure that there's greater movement and access, there's greater freedom of movement for goods and peoples, that we've allowed economic growth, and we believe, with more cooperation between the Israelis and the Palestinians, we can get that to double digits in 2010. We're trying to do everything we can to create a better picture on the ground, a better reality on the ground for Palestinians, because we want them to understand that the peace process is in their interests.
Do you think that the Nobel Peace Prize winning president of the United States is any more likely than any of his predecessors to achieve peace in your area?
I hope so. I think he's uniquely positioned to make a positive contribution. He has credibility in the Arab and Muslim world that maybe previous presidents of the United States did not have. And I'd remind you of his important speech in Cairo, where he stood up in the very center of the Arab world, in the very center of the Muslim world, and he said the bond between Israel and the United States is unbreakable. And he called upon the Arab world to move towards peace with Israel. And I think that that message is an important message, and we support that message.
Mark Regev, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.